I have good news and bad news for you today. The bad news is that you're not going to hear a joke or funny story from me. The good news is that I really think the message might be special. It's my privilege to introduce this guest speaker to you today. This is somebody who is a minister in Dayton, Ohio, but more than that, she's been in the Unity Movement for how many years? Since 1981. This is somebody who has some renown in the Unity Movement as one of the premier teachers. When I was going for my SEE, she was my instructor in about three or four classes. Not only is she an excellent instructor, on one occasion during the break, I got some bad news about the health of my daughter, and I was really kind of crestfallen. And when I walked back into the class, she picked up on it immediately and came to me and spoke to me and encouraged me and asked me if I needed more time. She was present to me. And I share that little anecdote with you because not only is she a very talented instructor, she's a really outstanding minister with a kind, loving heart. Her name is Jill, Reverend Jill Andrews, and it is my pleasure to introduce her, and she will be doing the talk and the meditation this morning.
So winter's here, isn't it? I'm wearing most of my clothes that I brought. Isn't that how it happens? Even when you live here, the first big winter blast of air. So I feel to some degree I'm home. What Mike did not share is I lived 26 years in Chicago before seminary, right from Ohio to Chicago. And I started at Unity in Chicago. I lived in Barrington in my later years and came here to work on my SEE classes. And I came to women's retreats. My home church was Evanston, but this is a special place in my heart because it's right down 59 for me, right? So I have some fond memories. Plus, I have been privileged to be nurturing some of your licensed teachers and hear your minister. So I'm happy to be back. So I promised that I would share a joke. So we'll see how that works, right, for this crowd. So three sons left home, and they went out on their own, and they prospered, and they thought, what a great idea. Let's give something back to our mother. And the first said, I've built a big house for my mom, for our mom. And the second one said, I bought her a Mercedes. And the third one said, I have you all, you both beat. You remember how mom enjoyed reading the Bible? Well, she can't see very well now, so I sent her this remarkable parrot that knows every Bible verse and recites the entire Bible. It took the elders in the church 12 years to teach him. So he's one of a kind, and mom just needs to name the chapter and the verse, and the parrot recites it. I'm going to add this. The parrot's name's Alexa. Added that. Okay, so mom sent out her letters of thanks to her sons. And the first one, she said, Dear Milton, the house that you built is too huge. I live in only one room, and I have to keep the whole house clean. So she wasn't very happy about that. Dear Gerald, she wrote to the second one, I am too old to travel, so I spend most of my time at home, and I don't have much use for the Mercedes. But to the third son, she said, Dearest Donald, you have the good sense to know what your mother likes. The chicken was delicious. Sit in line with what they're used to. So, how many of you are just about done with Christmas? Oh, no, you aren't. Because today is the 19th day of Christmas. And I understand when I was talking with Mike yesterday that you had a examination of the 12 days of Christmas. So on the 19th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 19 football playoffs. So how do I know Christmas is almost over? I was happy to see the poinsettias for this. Valentine's Day candy's in the stores. That's a good sign. And when I get home on Tuesday, I'm going to take down my artificial tree. It's time for that. But we all know when it's about time. But today, what I'm going to encourage you to do, we're focusing on everybody included, all is well, is to take the story, the heart of the Christmas message into our lives every day. It's not just that season. And the other thing that reinforces this season is love, peace, hope, and joy that is here in your sanctuary. Those are some of the messages of Christmas. But at the heart of the message is this story that I've chosen called No Room at the Inn, right? So we kind of know that part of the story is Joseph and his beloved wife Mary were called back to Joseph's hometown of Bethlehem for a census. And she's very pregnant, and they are turned down. There's no room at the inn. But eventually they bedded down in an area reserved for animals. And after the birth of Jesus, the baby Jesus was laying in a manger, which was for the animals. So the idea of this in our lives is, how do we make room for the Christ? And it continues to present itself to us all the time. Christmas or no Christmas, our world is changing even more rapidly now. And there's evidence of more division in the world, and constantly people are feeling more separation. So many people feel left out in the cold, and they wonder, is there room for me? Have you ever wondered that for something? So now it could be a senior in high school or college, and they're getting ready to graduate, and that's there's a lot of excitement now, because if they're from high school, they're waiting to see what college they might have been accepted into or what they might do next. Or if it's college, they're going on to their career, and is there room for me in what I think or what I want to have to do? And then there might be a woman living in society where glass ceilings are yet to be broken, and Me Too is a prevalent movement. And social media wonders, is there room for me, for my aspirations, for that which I want to give of my gifts? Maybe there's a white man tired of hearing about his unearned privilege and is confused over exactly what to do. And he says, will there be room for me if I let others in, if I let others have opportunities? What's going to happen to me? Will I still have a job? And then the young person who might have come out as gay and anticipates interactions with family members, friends, and says, is there room for me? And maybe the Syrian refugee or a Mexican refugee whose family is scattered all over the world and whose home has been decimated by violence. And he says, as he roams and tries to find a new home for himself and his family, is there room for me? So some insight in the scripture, back to the inn, right, is in the Revised Standard, the Revised English version of Luke 2.7. It's written, and she gave birth to her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloth, and laid him in a manger because there was no space at the inn or the guest room. So one of the things we did, I'm not doing that today, but that we did during Christmas was look at the story and some of the truth about it. Like, was there an inn? You know, and what do we think of as an inn? A cute little Airbnb? But was there an inn at the time? So some scholars believe that the word inn was more accurately translated as guest room or guest bed in the peasant house or a desert cave where Mary and Joseph more likely stopped. So this was not a place of business with a little innkeeper at the front and his wife with the broom. It was not some kind of a hotel. And Luke doesn't point us to a drafty stable with a door because 2,000 years ago, people kept their animals in their own home, possibly on the first floor. And so it wasn't, these are some scholars, possibly an outbuilding. It might have been the first floor, like the beginning of raised ranches, right? Only for animals. And Mary didn't go first to an inn. They were coming with their own family, and Eastern hospitality wouldn't have dreamt of leaving them without a place to stay. So perhaps the guest room in this home of her family members was already occupied, or perhaps the writer of the Gospel of Mark is just telling us that the spare room is not big enough for a birthing mother along with assisting her, so she needed to give birth in the main area of the home rather than somewhere else. So, and maybe they were just scared, oh my God, she's ready to have, her water's ready to burst at any moment, what are we going to do about it? So the natural place to lay the newborn while they're amongst their animals, where there's room, is in the manger, in the hay, and it's like long ago, some people put the baby in the drawer. We've heard of that. Maybe some of you had that or did that. But this is just like, it's a useful place in the home. And it's the center, in this case, it was the center of the family's living space, and it was immediately then part of their daily routine. So, yes, there was no bed for them, and there was no guest room with a private bath, no luxury to speak of at all. But there was room. They made room. And Mary and Joseph were taken in. And the baby was born, wrapped in bands of cloth, and placed in the manger. So with this perspective, not only was there room for Mary, Joseph, and their baby, but even today, we can know there's room for all. So today it seems like we're operating under a script that says there's not enough room, not enough resources, not enough jobs, not enough alternative sources of energy, not enough money, not enough love to conquer the hate and the good to overcome the evil. But this belief in scarcity arises out of fear and anxiety. The belief can lead us to hoard in excess, to isolate ourselves, to build walls, to choose sides, and to do whatever it takes to protect our own. But the birth of Jesus flips this script. It proclaims that the good news of great joy for all people, and no one is left out in the cold. Nor is anyone left out as Jesus grows up and purposely teaches and reaches out to those who have been left out. So some of my students know what that is. But who did Jesus reach out to in his life? The women, the children, the disenfranchised, the sinners, and woe is me, the despised tax collector. Jesus apparently and did believe that God was a given, and God gave in abundance. There is enough. There's room for all. So with that in mind, then on the previous examples, there's room for the graduating senior. There's room with a woman with career aspirations. There's room for the privileged and underprivileged. There's room for LGBTQ and all of us. There's room for the refugee and the minoritized. And there's room for all of us, and we are enough just as we are. So there were a couple stories in the holidays that really warmed my heart to this. And one of them is in the story, the theater production in New York of A Christmas Carol. And Tiny Tim in that story melts Scrooge's heart, if you remember that story. And so in this production, there were two young boys, 7 and 8 years old, that played the part of Tiny Tim. And remember, Tiny Tim, what did he do? Hobble around, right? He was crippled. And what's noteworthy of this production is that that lead boy, was played by two different 7-year-olds, both of whom had cerebral palsy with limited mobility, and they had scooters, and they just were the way they were. Also, one was Hispanic and one was Indian. This was revolutionary. Revolutionary in nobody, they had never cast somebody that was disabled or other abled to play this role. So it has, for centuries, this boy, Tiny Tim, has been on crutches. But with these two boys, we saw so much more. And these boys believed that what they could deliver was authenticity. They believed that if the role called for somebody to be crippled, that they should be the part, play the parts. So the young Sebastian Ortiz says, a character with a disability should not be played by a person without a disability because it's just not natural. Tiny Tim is much more like me. He's so much like me. He's happy. He's hopeful. And he has a disability. The other boy, Jace Srinivasan, encourages others by saying, tell all the kids they think that they can do it, that they think can't do it, that they actually can. Just believe in yourself. What a timely message. Just believe in yourself. If you believe you can't do it, what do we know in unity to be true? Change our minds, right? We can do it. They had a belief. They were actors. They wanted to do this. They got those parts, and they're a demonstration to many, of which nobody complained that an able-bodied person was playing Tiny Tim. In fact, it was impressionable. And the demonstration of these two young men of brown color and disabled had many others relate to them, while all of us have all of it to relate to. So they're a living demonstration of being inclusive. And what a demonstration that all can be invited to the table. The other one is an example in the arts as well. It is the Nutcracker Ballet, the production by the New York City Ballet. And that's classic. It's been performed for 30 years. But this year, there was a new twist. The 11-year-old Charlotte Nebres became the first black dancer to win the coveted role of Marie, the heroine of the Nutcracker story. And again, her story is an example of the changing role in our society, the changing role in a deeply entrenched way of doing things, American ballet. So each year, students from the famed American Ballet School vie for positions and perfect their skills so that they can move up to the New York City Ballet. And in 1934, when George Balanchine founded the American Ballet, it was his intention that these children are nurtured and nurtured to be all they can be and move into the ballet. However, for dancers of color, it was so difficult to get there. They encountered many invisible barriers to many, which were blatant to them. It was a lot of small things that added up, like not having proper stage makeup for their color skin, not having hair products that they can use on their hair. And they said these actions, the people that were the directors, these actions were not malicious. It was invisible to them and just the way it had always been. So they thought over the past years, if they bring in a person of color, okay. They didn't think the makeup people and the hair people would have an issue with it, right? And so it seemed like a little slight to those people that were trying to move into a greater part of their expression of life. So there was an interview with this young Charlotte, the 11-year-old, and the reporter said, since 1954, there's never been a Marie that looks like you. And her response was this. At first, when I found that out, I found it to be a bit surprising. Then it sunk in. If I'm going to do this role, and I'm the first person to do it, I want to make it count. I really want to make it special for everyone in the audience and all of those on the stage as well. Her mother, Danielle, said it wasn't long that this kind of opportunity would not have been possible for her daughter because her mother had been engaged in that ballet company too, the American Ballet Company. She said, it's magical for me to see this hopefulness and just realizing that there is no limit. I'm learning through her that maybe the way things were aren't what they are any longer. And what moved me a lot about this story was the wisdom from these young people about, I want to make a difference, and the ability to articulate it. So the good news is now dancers are given proper color makeup and hair products that work for them. And what's significant with the story of Charlotte was, I'll call her, they took her as is. They asked for no changes. In fact, they wanted her just the way they are. Whatever her native hair is, whatever her skin is, we want you to play this part, and it's by her talents. So this is a message for everyone, but particularly for women of color, let's say, to know who you are is enough, and you are beautiful as you are. And the beautiful message is you don't need to change a thing. How many of us, whatever, our stature, our wishes, the color of our skin, can go to that mirror and know and look ourselves in the eyes and the face and know that we are good enough just the way we are? So the other news is the new artistic director who used to be a ballet, it's a white man who used to be a ballet member of the troupe, says things are going to change, and he's working on the cast reflecting more of New York City's population. Now, what do we know about New York City's population? Lots of different ethnicities. So that's going to be enriching to the arts. He reflected, though, it's been a long time coming. He said, unfortunately, the country we live in our country, there have been policies and practices that have been codified from very early on and strengthened over the years that do not allow equal opportunity for every person. Ballet was very much a European art form, so it came over with standards of beauty that were based on that European model, and it was very, very white. We are in a position, he said, to tell people what is beautiful. We can change people's idea of what is beautiful by what and who we put on stage. That is our responsibility. We can change people's perceptions of what ballet is. But to conclude that interview, Charlotte's asked, what do you want people in the audience to feel when they see you on stage? And the 11-year-old said, I want them to feel empowered because you get to see someone like you on the stage. I want them to think, if she did it, I can do it too. If any of them did it, if anybody you see is doing something that you want to do, who also can do it? Come on, ready? Me? Yeah, all of us. And we change our thinking. And that's the gift of the Unity teaching, one of the many. So this coming week, we celebrate the anniversary of Martin Luther King's birthday. And I remind you of his efforts to awaken the American people to equality. His birthday is on the 15th, which is Wednesday. So we are tied together. This is his quote. We are tied together in a single garment of destiny, caught in it. And caught in an inescapable network of reality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until you are what you ought to be. You can't be what you ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And this is the way God's universe is made. So this week, this Wednesday, and I think it's next Monday is the official holiday, just remember the message that Martin Luther King gave his life for, that all are created equal, all deserve to be at the table, come to the table. So what does all this stuff that I've talked about mean? The story of Jesus, the story of the ballet, the story of Scrooge, and the story, a little snippet of Martin Luther King. What does it mean to us, and what can we do with it? Well, that is something for you to reflect on and for you to personalize. But for me, I can begin always with love. Do I always begin with love, always? No. But the more that I become aware of my intention and awake to it, I can start with love. And if it's not, I can pull back. I can do a redo. I can start with love, loving all, judging less, loving more. I can acknowledge that every life matters. I can embrace and bring in those who are disenfranchised. I can just be awake enough to connect with people everywhere I am. As in, think about, I get back into Chicago traffic and not necessarily want to engage with people, but the grocery store, places that you might discount the people who work there. You can make their day, and you can make a lot of people's day just by smiling and saying hello simply. I can let my heart be that innkeeper that opens myself to all, to keep opening my heart, to keep being vulnerable, to keep feeling feelings, and I can make room for all. So now as we go into meditation, I have a special treat for you because this is what this talk was based on. This video that I saw in December is called At the Table, At This Table, and it was created. The song was written by Idina Menzel, and she is known for Frozen, that song, along with a few others. Can these lights come off for that? Mm-hmm. And so now we'll... Here's what I want you to do. Enjoy the video, and right after the video, take it into the silence, and then at some point we're going to start coming out of the silence to end our meditation.